or keep them on as you wish. There's no need to look at the screen for this half hour of time that we're gathered here. We always start with a calming and meditation, followed by as much of a calm read of the Chronicles of Narnia as one could imagine. Last week was quite a difficult read as we approach toward the end of the novel and encounter some difficulties with Aslan. And of course, the White Witch is not far behind those difficulties. And we've talked a lot about how important our imaginations are and how important stories are. You can see what an imagination C.S. Lewis had. He was the author of this book. And all of the 7 books of the Chronicles of Narnia. In fact, this is just the first one. And it looks to me like we're going to get to the end. We've got 40 pages left. I hope it picks up a little from last week. It was rather sad. Just practice letting go of the end of your day. Breathing in. See if you can try this activity. You can breathe in. Take one of your thumbs and close half of your nose with your nostril and breathe in the other half. And then on the exhale, breathe out that half and breathe in. So you can start right nostril, cover that, breathe in your left. Now cover your left and breathe out your right. Now breathe in your right, cover your left, or cover your right. Now breathe out your left. Breathe in your left. Cover your left, breathe out your right. Breathe in your right. Cover your right, breathe out your left. Breathe in your left. Cover your left, breathe out your right. Kind of like Dr. Mel was talking about, we have all these things inside of our brain, on both sides of our brain. And in yoga practice, when you do alternating nostril breath like that, you can help to balance your brain rhythms and get things all synced up and working well together, just like tires on a car or any vehicle. You want them going at the same speed in the same direction at the same time. And that alternating breath is just like that for our bodies. So we've got ourselves around the stone table, and we've got something a little peculiar happening with Aslan. We're not quite sure from last week what's going on next. There's ogres with monstrous teeth and wolves and bull-headed men. Spirits of evil trees and poisonous plants, and other creatures whom I won't describe, because if I did, the grown-ups would probably not let you read this book, like ghouls and hags and incubuses and wraiths and horrors and ifrits and sprites and orkneys and woozies and ettins. In fact, here were all those who were on the witch's side and whom the wolf had summoned at her command. And right in the middle, standing by the table, was the witch herself. A howl and a gibber of dismay went up from the creatures when they first saw the great lion pacing toward them. And for a moment, the witch herself seemed to be struck with fear. Then she recovered herself and gave a wild, fierce laugh. "The fool," she cried. "The fool has come. Bind him fast." Lucy and Susan held their breaths, waiting Aslan's roar and his spring upon his enemies, but it never came. Four hags, grinning and leering, yet also at first hanging back and half afraid of what they had to do, had approached him. "Bind him, I say," repeated the white witch. The hags made a dart at him and shrieked with triumph when they found that he made no resistance at all. Then others, evil dwarfs and apes, rushed in to help them, and between them they rolled the huge lion on his back and tied all of his paws together, shouting and cheering as if they had done something brave, though the lion had chosen one of those paws could have been the death of them all. He made no noise, even when the enemies straining and tugging pulled the cords so tight that they cut into his flesh. Then they began to drag him toward the stone table. "Stop," said the witch. "Let him first be shaved." Another roar of mean laughter went up from her followers as an ogre with a pair of shears came forward and squatted down by Aslan's head. Snip, snip, snip went the shears, and masses of curling gold began to fall to the ground. Then the ogre stood back, and the children, watching from their hiding place, could see the face of Aslan looking all small and different without its mane. The enemies also saw the difference. "Why, he's only a great cat, after all," cried one. "Is that what we're afraid of?" said the other. And they surged around Aslan, jeering at him, saying things like, "How many mice have you caught today, little cat?" And, "Would you like a saucer of milk, pussums?" "Oh, how can they," said Lucy, tears streaming down her cheeks. "Those brutes, those brutes." For now, the first shock was over, and the shorn face of Aslan looked to her braver and ever more beautiful than before. "Muzzle him," said the witch. And even now, as they worked about his face, putting on the muzzle, one bite from his jaws would have cost two or three of them their hands. But he never moved, and this seemed to enrage all that rabble. Everyone was at him now, even those who had been afraid to come near him. Even after he was bound, began to find their courage, and for a few minutes the two girls could not even see him. So thickly was he surrounded by the whole crowd of creatures, kicking him, hitting him, spitting on him, and jeering at him. At last, the rabble had had enough of this, and they began to drag the bound and muzzled lion to the stone table. He was so huge that even when they got him there, it took all of their efforts to hoist him onto the surface. "The cowards, the cowards," cried Susan. "Are they still afraid of him even now?" When once Aslan had been tied and tied and was just a mass of cords on the flat stone, a hush fell on the crowd. The four hags holding the four torches stood at the four corners of the table. The witch bared her arms as she had bared them the previous night when it had been Edmund instead of Aslan. Then she began with her knife, looked to the children, and with the gleam of the torchlight fell on it. The knife were made of stone, it looked, and not of steel, and it became of a strange and evil shape. At last she drew near. She stood by Aslan's head. Her face was working and twitching with passion, but his looked up at the sky, still quiet, neither angry nor afraid, but quite sad. Then just before she gave the blow, she stooped down and said in a quivering voice, "And now, who has won? Fool, did you think that by all this you would save the human traitor? Now I will kill you instead of him, as our pact was, and so the deep magic will be appeased. But when you are dead, what will prevent me from killing him as well? And who will take him out of my hand then? Understand that you have given me Narnia forever, and you have lost your own life, and you have not saved his. In that knowledge, despair and die." And the children did not see the actual moment. They could not bear to look and covered their eyes. While the two girls still crouched in the bushes with the hands over their faces, they heard the voice of the witch calling out, "Now follow me all, and we will set about what remains of this war. It will not take us long to crush the human vermin and traitors now that the great fool, the great cat, lies dead." At this moment, the children were far from great danger. For with wild cries and a noise of skirling pipes and shrill horns blowing, the whole of that vile rabble came sweeping off the hilltop and down the slope, right past their hiding place. They felt the specters go by them like a cold wind, and they felt the ground shake beneath them under the galloping feet of the minotaurs, and overhead there went a flurry of foul wings and a blackness of vultures and giant bats. At any other time, they would have trembled with fear, but now the great sadness and shame of Aslan's death filled their minds. As soon as the wood was silent again, Susan and Lucy crept out on top of the hill. The moon was getting low, and thin clouds were passing them. But still, they could see the great shape of the lion lying dead in his bonds. They knelt down into the wet grass and kissed his face and cried till they could cry no more. At last Lucy said, "I can't bear to look at this horrible muzzle. I wonder if we should take it off." And they tried with cold fingers, and they succeeded. And when they saw his face, they burst out crying yet again. "I wonder if we could untie him as well," said Susan. But the cords had been drawn so tight that they could make nothing of them. I hope none of you who are reading this book feel ever quite as miserable as Susan and Lucy felt that night. You might feel as if nothing ever better is going to happen again. But with hours passed and the night lingering on the sky to the east side of the hill, it was a little less dark than it had been an hour ago. And there was some tiny movement suddenly at their feet. Whatever it was that had begun to move, scurried across the stone's table. She looked closer. "Ugh, how beastly. There are horrid little mice crawling all over him. Go away, you little beasts," and she shooed them away. "Wait," Lucy said, "can't you see what they're doing? They're nibbling away at the cords. These are friendly mice, poor little things. They don't know that he's dead. They're trying to untie him." And at last, one by one, all the ropes were gnawed. The sky in the east was whitish, and the stars were getting fainter. The mice crept away, and the girls cleared off the remaining of the gnawed ropes. As the light grew lighter still, they could see Aslan's face, looking nobler still. For hours and hours, birds gave a chuckling sound, and now there were birds singing all over the place. It was definitely early morning now. "I'm so cold," Lucy said. "So am I," said Susan. "Let's walk about for a bit." And they walked to the eastern edge of the hill and looked down. The one big star had almost disappeared, and the country looked gray. At last, they stood for a moment looking toward Caer Paravel, where the red turned to gold along with the line of the sea and the sky that met slowly at the edge of the sun. And they heard a great loud noise, cackling, as if a giant had broken a giant's plate. "What's that?" said Lucy, clutching Susan's arm. "I feel afraid to turn around. Something awful is happening. They're doing something worse to him." The stone table had broken by the time they'd gotten back into two pieces, and the great crack that ran down it from end to end, and there was no Aslan. "What's been done? What is the meaning of this? Is this more magic?" "Yes," said the great voice behind their backs, "it is more magic." There, shining in the sunrise, larger than they had ever seen him before, stood Aslan himself. "Oh, Aslan," cried both the children. "Aren't you dead, dear Aslan?"
"Not now."
"You're not a
ghost?"
Aslan stooped over and licked her forehead.
"Do I look like it?"
"Oh, you're real, Aslan. What does this all mean?"
"It means that though the witch knew the deep magic, there is a magic deeper still, which she did not know. Her knowledge goes back only to the dawn of time. If she could have still looked further back into the stillness and darkness before dawn, she would have read a different incantation. She would have known that when a willing victim who had committed no treachery was killed in a traitor's stead, the table would crack and death itself would start working backward. And now, oh, children, I feel my strength coming back to me. Catch me if you can." And he stood quivering with all his limbs from head to tail and laughing. Lucy scrambled over to reach him, and Aslan leaped again, and suddenly a mad chase began round and round the hilltop, from tail to head, catching and paws flying about, leaping with fur and arms and legs. It was such a romp as no one had ever had except in Narnia. And whether it was more like playing with a thunderstorm or playing with a kitten, Lucy could not make up her mind. "And now," Aslan said, "to business. I feel I am going to roar. You had better put your ears in your fingers." And they did, and Aslan stood up, and when he opened his mouth to roar, his face became so terrible that they did not dare look at him. And they saw all the trees in front of him bend before the blast of his roaring, and grass bends in the meadow before the wind. Then he said, "We have a long journey to go. You must ride on me." And he crouched down, and the children climbed on. The ride was perhaps the most beautiful thing that had ever happened to them. Imagine just that golden fur and mane flying around in the wind. And then imagine going twice as fast as you've ever even been, even on a horse. And Aslan flew and flew all around the beeches and the oaks and the wild orchards of the snow-white cherry trees, past the waterfalls and the mossy rocks and caverns, all through the wild valleys and acres of blue flowers. It was nearly midday when they found themselves looking down a steep hillside at a castle. A little toy castle, it looked, from where they stood. The lion was rushing at such a speed that they weren't quite sure what that was. "The witch's home," he cried. "Now, children, hold tight." They flew down into the White Witch's castle, right into the middle of a stone courtyard full of statues. "What an extraordinary place," cried Lucy. "All those stone animals and people too. It's like a museum." Aslan was bound up to the stone lion and breathed on him, and then without a moment whisked around and was standing a few feet from the lion with his back to it. Then he pounced on a tall stone dryad, which stood beside the dwarf, and rapidly aside to deal with a stone rabbit. And little by little, right after Aslan had breathed upon them, a gold streak began to run along the white marble, and then it spread, and the color overtook the statues. And suddenly, the hair was living. It was stone no more, and the mouth of the lion opened and gave a prodigious yawn. And stretched his hind legs, lifted one by one. And they soon saw how wonderful it was that all the statues were coming to life. It wasn't a courtyard anymore like a museum. It looked more like a zoo. Creatures were running after Aslan and dancing all around him. Foxes and dogs and unicorns, centaurs and birds and satyrs, and yellow stockings and crimson hoods of the dwarfs, and birch gills in silver. "Oh," said Susan, "look, I wonder. I mean, is it safe?" "It's all right. Once the feet are put right, all the rest of them will follow." A giant rubbed his eyes, kicked his feet, and said, "Bless me, I must have been asleep. Now where's that dratted little witch that was running about on the ground? Somewhere just by my feet it was." For giants, remember, are rather tall. "Now look, everyone, inside the house, upstairs and downstairs, in the ladies' chamber, leave no corner unsearched. You never know where some poor prisoner may be concealed. Go at once and let us clear the house. Don't forget the dungeons. And look out for trapped doors. There's a whole lot more on the landing. Aslan, Aslan, I found Mr. Tumnus. Oh, do come quick." A moment later, Lucy and the little fawn were holding one another by hands and dancing round and round for joy. The ransacking at last of the witch's fortress was ended, and the whole castle was emptied head to toe, door to window. The whole crowd of liberated statues surged into the back courtyard. And Mr. Tumnus said, "But how are we going to get out?" For Aslan said, "That'll be all right." "Hi," he said to the giant, "what's your name?" "Giant Rumblebuffin, if it please your honor," said the giant, once more touching his cap. "Well then, Giant Rumblebuffin, just let us out of this, will you?" "Certainly, your honor. It will be a pleasure. Stand well away from the gates." Let's see, I'm having a little tricky with this. "Have you got a pocket handkerchief about you?" "Yes, I have," said Lucy. "Thank you." "Here's my handkerchief." She handed it to him. He had mistaken the little girl for the handkerchief. Considering how small the Daughters of Eve handkerchief was, it was, unfortunately, of no use to Mr. Rumblebuffin. At this point, Aslan clapped his paws together and called for a silence. Our day's work is not yet over, and if the witch is to finally be defeated, we must find the battle at once. Those who can't keep up must ride on the back of those who can, and those who are good with the noses must come in the front to smell out where the battle is. Everyone was pleased, and the lion, the new unstoned lion, kept busy. All us lions stand in the front, Aslan and him. When they were ready, they set out through the gap in the castle wall. At first, the lions and the dogs went nosing about in all directions. The noise was like an English fox hunt, only better, because every now and then the music of the hounds crept up. Faster and faster they went, and the scene became easier and easier to follow. They went through a narrow valley, and there stood Peter and Edmund and all the rest of Aslan's army fighting desperately against the crowd of horrible creatures. The witch was fighting only with her stone knife, and it was Peter she was fighting. Peter's sword was flashing so quickly that it looked like three swords. Aslan roared, took after the White Witch, and soon enough, the lion and the White Witch rolled over together, but with the witch underneath, all of the warlike creatures at the same moment took their swords and their hooves. Soon enough, the battle was all over. Most of the enemy had been killed in the first charge of Aslan and his companions. The next thing that Lucy knew was that Peter and Aslan were shaking hands. It was strange to hear what had happened. It was all Edmund's doing, Aslan. The witch was turning our troops into stone right and left, and Aslan fought his way through. Edmund was in charge of Mrs. Beaver, a little way back from the fighting line. He was covered in blood and his mouth was open. Lucy remembered the precious cordial that had been given to her for Christmas. There are other people wounded, Aslan said, while she still looking eagerly toward Edmund's pale face and wondering if the cordial would help at all. Daughter of Eve, others also are at the point of death. Must more people die for Edmund? I'm sorry, Aslan, and she got up and started handing out her cordial to anyone she could help. Aslan, on the field of battle, made Edmund a knight. That night, they slept where they were. Aslan provided food for them, and the next day, they began marching eastward, down the side of the great river. And the day after that, they reached the mouth, and the next day, Caer Paravel, with its little hill towards the sands and the rocks and the little pools of salt water and seaweed and the smell of the sea and the long miles of bluish green waves breaking forever and ever on the beach. And the seagulls, have you heard them? Aslan solemnly crowned each one. Long live King Peter. Long live Queen Susan. Long live King Edmund. Long live Queen Lucy. Once a king or a queen in Narnia, always a king or a queen. Bear it well, sons of Adam and daughters of Eve. And through the eastern door, mermaids swimming close to the castle steps and singing in the honor of their new kings and queens. The children all sat around their thrones. And Aslan, as usual, amidst the celebrations, snuck out without saying a word. This story is nearly at the end. The two kings and queens governed Narnia well, and long and happy was their reign. The White Witch's army was destroyed. They kept good laws and made peace and saved trees from unnecessarily being cut down. Ordinary people were allowed to live out their dreams. And they themselves grew and changed as the years went on. They were knights. They were ambassadors. They were councilmen and judges. Lucy was even called Queen Lucy, the Valiant. They lived a life of great joy. And if ever they remembered their life in this world, it was only as one remembers a dream. And one year it fell out that Tumnus came down the river and brought them news that the White Stag had once more appeared in these parts. The White Stag who would give you wishes if you caught him. So the two kings and queens rode a-hunting with horns and hounds to follow the White Stag. They found the White Stag, King Peter, and he said, "Fair friends, here is a great marvel, for I seem to see a tree of iron. If you look well upon it, you shall see it is a pillar of iron with a lantern set on the top thereof." "What a strange device to set a lantern here where the trees cluster so thick about." "Sir," Queen Lucy, "by likelihood, where this post and this lamp were set here, there were smaller trees in the place, or fewer, or none. This is young wood, and the iron post is old. For it will not go out of my mind that when we pass this post and lantern, either we shall find strange adventures, or else some great change of our fortunes." "Madam," said King Edmund, "the like foreboding stirreth in my heart also, and in mine, fair brother, and in mine too. Wherefore, by my counsel, we shall lightly return to our horses and follow this White Stag no further. For ever since there were four kings and queens in Narnia, we have set our hands to high matters, and we have achieved the same. In the name of Aslan, if ye will all have it so, let us go on and take the adventure that shall fall to us." And the queens and kings entered the thicket at the lamp and the post. And before they had gone a score of paces, they all remembered that the thing that seen was called a lamp post. And before they had gone 20 more, they noticed that they were making their way not through branches, but through posts. And next moment, they all came tumbling out of a wardrobe door into the empty room, and they were no longer kings and queens in their hunting array, but just Peter, Susan, Edmund, and Lucy in their old clothes. It was the same day and the same hour of the day on which they had all gone into the wardrobe to hide. Mrs. MacCready and the visitors were still talking in the passage, but luckily they never came into the empty room and the children weren't caught. And that would have been the end of the story if they hadn't had to explain to the professor why the four coats out of his wardrobe were missing. But the professor believed the whole story. "I don't think it will be any good trying to get back through the wardrobe to get those coats. You won't get into Narnia again that route. And what use would the coats be of to you now?" Once a king in Narnia, always a king in Narnia. And once a queen in Narnia, always a queen in Narnia. But you can never use the same route twice. Keep your eyes open. And at this, it was the very end of the adventures of the wardrobe. But if the professor was right, it was only the beginning of the adventures of Narnia.
When will we start the next book?
Hey, buddy, don't interrupt.